Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Thinking about this program, I wrote down that the practice of pediatrics now appears to be slowly evolving from this idea of treating acute infectious disease problems and preventing them with immunizations toward really helping families understand more and more how to promote health. Perhaps one of the most important examples of this is helping parents and caregivers understand the basics of early childhood brain development and also the consequences of early environmental exposures, such as exposures to books, screen time, and something we're going to define as toxic stress on this program and how it affects early childhood brain development. Our guest today is Dr. Dipesh Navzaria. He is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and at the School of Public Health. Dr. Navzaria is really committed to developing a passion for reading in children that he meets. In addition to his medical degree, he also holds master's degrees in library and information sciences. So to reach us over the next hour or so while we're doing this program, let me remind you our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. The toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, as usual, is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Navzaria, it is a pleasure to have you join us. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm equally pleased to be here.
Dr. Navzaria is joining us by telephone from Wisconsin. He'll be visiting next week, and we'll talk about some of the reasons for that during the program. As we talked before the program, you say everybody wants to know how you got into the library degree along with a medical degree. So tell us a little bit about that story.
Sure. That's certainly a common question that I get because it's not a common combination of degrees to have. So I actually was a physician assistant before I went to medical school and practiced outpatient pediatrics. And even prior to that time, I had encountered the Reach Out and Read early literacy program back in Boston where it first started. So I knew something about the importance of reading and sharing books with kids and promoting that idea, but I realized that I didn't know as much as I would have really liked about the books themselves, about children's books and what's in them and what makes for a high-quality children's book. And I was living in East Central Illinois at the time in Champaign-Urbana, the home of the flagship campus of the University of Illinois, did a little searching and found there was a wonderful place called the Center for Children's Books, which is a research collection all about children's literature. And I discovered that they were housed in the library school there, and only a few, like about 2 miles from my home. Ended up paying them a visit, and let's just say that they were very persuasive about how delightful it would be to spend more time looking at all this information. And I'd enrolled in medical school, took one course with them during my second year of med school, and just fell in love with the entire concept of learning about information, about learning about children's literature, libraries, and so on. And before I knew it, I was taking a year off in the middle of med school to do the full master's in library science, primarily focused on children's literature, although I did do some other coursework as well.
That is unique. I think it says a lot about you and your interests, but your willingness to get into things in great depth, and your interest in childhood education and reading.
Yeah, it's certainly, and you know, the other interesting part about it was not just the reason I was there, which was really to learn about children's literature, but I learned that in discussing information science and how we work with people looking for information, I realized that, you know, there's a lot that goes on in healthcare that is really about information science. I was stunned when they talked about, you know, the basics of how you do a good reference interview when a library patron comes up to a reference desk and says, I need such and such. And they were talking about how you help them narrow that question and help them with their true needs and not just the question that they might think they have sometimes. And I remember sitting there stunned and saying, wow, this is exactly how we teach medical interviewing. Yeah. This is the same set of concepts.
The other thought I thought you were going to go with is we had, or I had, I guess, sent some information to you about what we might talk about, and we talked about how you have gotten interested in the narrative medical aspects of things. So that makes a lot of, it seems to me to fit in very well, that we as humans, the way our brains work is we like stories better than we like data, so to speak.
Data, and we like stories better than we do isolated facts. By necessity, some of our training, particularly in healthcare, asks us to ask for isolated facts. You know, where does this child live? What is the father's profession? Where did the mother grow up? You know, and then of course all the usual technical data. But sometimes we're very good at relating the technical data to each other, and we lose sight of the big picture. What is this family like? How do they relate to one another? Do they seem to like each other? Do they support each other? What do they see as each other's strengths and weaknesses? And I think that really comes from stories and letting them share stories with you in order to get that full total picture of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, being able to let the patients talk and not that dominate the time together so much in our with our sterile medical approach to things. So. Well, what I would like the listeners to hear is we're going to start off today by asking Dr. Devzaria a little bit about brain development and where we are with understanding that, particularly as it relates to young infants and children, and then how environment can influence that development. Use reading as a perhaps positive example, and something we'll define later as toxic stress as a negative influence, and how that can lead to and affect brain development. So let's try to have our listeners go over some of the pertinent early or knowledge about how we understand that nervous system of infants and children are developing, if you don't mind.
Certainly. This is a fascinating topic, and, you know, I will actually preface my comments by saying that I personally was never a fan of my neuroscience courses or my endocrinology courses, so I find it ironic that I spend so much time talking now about the nervous system and the stress response system, because I've now found that really if you think about how this applies to people in the context of society and their daily lives, it makes a lot more sense and relates to their lives. So I think the first thing to realize really is that child development is not just simply important for that child. It's actually important for our society as a whole. Children are very literally our futures. You know, they are our future members of society. They're our future workforce. They are the people who will be making decisions. They will be the folks that are producing things. Investing in our children from a young age is not just a nice thing to say, oh, think about the children. That it is very much an issue of economic development as well as something that's important to that individual child and family. I think the other thing that's really key, the other underlying principle, is that brains are built over time. It's not a one-time or a one-shot deal. So, for example, in many places, we like to spend a lot of time and money and effort on looking at literacy skills in, say, the third grade. And one of the key reasons, unfortunately, behind that is because universally we tend to measure literacy across, you know, many populations in the fourth grade. But if you focus just on the third grade, what about the 8 years that came in the child's life before then? Even before a child is actively reading, there are circuits being laid, groundwork being formed for that child to become, hopefully, a fluent reader. So we need to think about the long view, about supporting the brain from the earliest 1,000 days of life, all the way through and into and all the way through to the end of adulthood. Likewise, if a child has an early issue, that's not necessarily always a, oh, now, you know, we have no, this child won't amount to anything, oh, this is permanent damage or something like that. It is possible, depending again on the nature of what's going on, it is possible to work around that if there's good support, good connections, all those sorts of things. So having said those two statements, I think the next key part is really what in the world shapes the developing brain? you know, what are the influencers? And there really are two big, kind of big picture influencers. One is genetics, and the other is experience. So it's not just one or the other. And I like to think of it almost like being like a campfire. Genes are the firewood, and experience is the spark. You need both in order to have that fire. So when you have both genes and experience together, you could have good outcomes if you have, quote-unquote, good genes and good experiences, or you could have not-so-good outcomes if you have not-so-good genes being activated and not-so-good experience. So what decides which way that's going to go? It is, again, it's those environmental influencers, and the most key thing, and this literally shapes the architecture, the developing brain, the physical brain itself, is the nature of a child's relationship with caring adults around them. And I'm going to say that again because I think it's so important. It's the nature of children's relationships with caring adults around them that shapes the architecture of the developing brain. Because that is what decides, in a sense, the path. Is it going to be the better path or the not-so-good path that that brain takes in terms of its future learning? And this starts to happen very early in life, as in the opening months of life, really, and carries through certainly the first 5 years of life and beyond.
Are the studies that are looking at this, then I guess you'd say the nature, nurture, the genetics, the experience, the environment, those are all being evaluated. So those are controlled for, we might say, in the studies, since we've recognized these as the two major influences, as you said. So people who are listening to this should be able to say that we've gotten to where we are in the understanding by understanding these two influences and making sure we're considering them and how we're researching and studying this issue.
Yeah, that is correct. And actually, one of the best paradigms out there was developed by a Dr. Edward Tronick, who is actually my boss when I was an undergraduate working at Children's Hospital in Boston. He's the head of the child development unit there, and he came up with something called the face-to-face paradigm, where we would sit a baby in a car seat and have their mother sit across from them. And basically, they'd look at each other, and we'd instruct the parent, okay, for 2 minutes, play with your child as you normally would. And they would talk and sing and, you know, smile and laugh, and baby would point, and mom would look where they were pointing. And they'd really go back and forth, kind of playing off of each other, almost like two musicians, you know, jamming with each other, so to speak. And then, when we signal the mother, we have her turn away for a moment, and when she turns back, we ask her to hold a still face. Just no facial expression that's completely flat. And then we'd watch on tape, what does the baby do? Does the baby try to bring the mother back? You know, hey, you know, what's going on? Now, these are young children. It depends on the specific paradigm, but a year of age, for example. And you'd see in some of the classic examples that the baby would get more upset. They'd point because they said, oh, mom looked when I pointed. What's going on here? You know, and then they'd try more and more, piece by piece, to try to bring the mother back. And then they'd often get upset and start to cry. And then after 2 minutes, we'd signal to the mom. She'd turn away again and then turn back, and she'd be back to normal. And we'd see how would the baby respond to this reuniting, to this, okay, things are back to normal, et cetera. And, of course, again, in the prototypical model, the baby would be happy again and all would be well. And this has been used as a way of looking at relationships between parent and child and looking at the other factors that influence how these relationships may play out, because there's certainly models in which one could say that maternal depression could be mimicked by that flat affect, substance abuse. And in other cases, even sociocultural differences. If you're not used to playing with your child face-to-face, if you're not thinking that this is something that you know how to do, if it's not been modeled for you, then it's very hard to be suddenly there in front of your child and say, wait a minute, what am I supposed to do here?
I've heard this described as kind of a serve-and-return kind of activity with this FaceTime that Dr. Tronick had talked about, so that when that mother smiles and the baby smiles back and back, they're kind of serving and returning that information to each other. And the baby, in a sense, may be learning, this is what it takes to get my attention. Whereas if he serves a smile and you don't get a smile back, then they may eventually start crying or whining or having behaviors that are not acceptable. That's the only way they've learned to get attention, and then that continues and leads to some of the behavioral issues that we might. Is that reasonable to talk about and make sense?
I think so. Certainly the serve and return metaphor has been used, and I think is exactly what's going on. It's this back and forth, this responding to one another or not responding to one another, as the case may be. I think the other upshot of this is that it tells us that children do actually learn well from relationships and from caring adults. There's some other work that's been done actually right here at the University of Wisconsin showing that young children don't actually understand the difference between a person in front of them and a person on a screen. The age varies in terms of with the individual child. So somewhere between 18 to 30 months of age, like in that time period, before then, a child... if they're demonstrated how to do something by a person in front of them, they'll learn. If they are shown the same person doing the same thing on a screen, they won't learn from that. And then somewhere between 18 to 30 months of age, they start to realize that this moving thing on the screen is actually a recording of a person doing the same sort of thing, and they can start to learn from that. And this has some interesting implications for, you know, screen time with young children and so on, because, you know, there is a lot of that, oh, you know, my child is learning to do this from the screen, isn't that great? And it actually, you know, there may not be true learning going on. It may be more of a conditioned stimulus response thing, as opposed to, say, a four-year-old, where they would learn that more deeply.
Let me take 1 second, remind our listeners you're listening to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. My guest today is Dr. Dipesh Navzaria. He is a pediatrician, assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin, and somewhat of an expert on brain development and the early influences, particularly reading and toxic stress on the child's developing brain. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear today, you can reach us locally at 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, again, is line1@alaskapublic.org. If we take this idea of babies learning early to kind of, in a sense, serve and return, and that has long-term consequences perhaps on behavior, I've tried to take that into a structural basis in the brain when I'm talking to patients, in the sense that I do this, and I want to tell you what I'm doing because I want you to either say, yep, that makes sense, or no, you're wrong, and we got to look at it a little differently. But I tell my parents that our brain is evolved to learn extremely well. It doesn't unlearn very well. And so if we learn to ride a bicycle, you can't tell me how to unlearn a bicycle anytime the rest of your life. And the reason that is that it really gets down to a structural circuit in the brain that gets reinforced and reinforced and reinforced. And it's really a structural entity, so to speak, so that children who learn certain behaviors and things early in life, it gets much, much more difficult to change those later in life, just like it is hard for me to learn new eating habits. Is that fair to use that kind of analogy to talk to parents about these issues with child development?
I think it's reasonable to use that analogy that that behaviors become ingrained and they're very hard to change later on. You know, at the same time, it's not that a behavior, of course, can never be unlearned or changed. It's a matter of the motivation of the will or you know, practicing not doing something or practicing a different habit instead. Right. I think there's definitely something there, though. And you know, the difference is, of course, that 90% of the brain's capacity to change, to really fundamentally realign its direction in terms of all the capabilities that we want children to have when they start school, really happens in the first 5 years of life. Now, that's not to say that you just give up if a kid is 6 or 9 or 15, you know, or as an adult at 25. But if you're going to have the most bang for your buck in terms of time spent, money spent, interventions, things like that, it's going to be in the first thousand or two thousand days of life, really, that first 3 to 5 years, where you're going to be able to make the biggest difference, because the brain is wiring at an incredible rate. In late infancy and toddlerhood, we're looking at 700 new neurons per second. I mean, that's so much capacity to change in that period of time. Of course, if you look at spending on programs to quote-unquote change behavior, to change the brain, including, you know, juvenile justice and mental health and all those sorts of things, very little, only about 5% is spent on the before 5 years of age group, and most is spent later on, particularly in late teens and early adulthood. So we kind of have an opposite setup of where we're spending our money versus the capacity of the brain to change easily.
Mm-hmm. I don't pretend to think that's the reason why, but my understanding is some of the more Scandinavian countries have always put more emphasis on this early developmental period with some of their policies for time off during pregnancy, and I'm not sure how they address the schools, but am I off base there, or is that one true that these countries do that, and that's part of the reason for that?
That's certainly something that is done in those countries. I can't tell you whether that was done based on science or whether it was done based on other notions of, you know, what was valued there. I will tell you that the United Kingdom, in their attempts to they declared a war on childhood poverty about 10 years ago, and they decided they'd do many different types of things. And one of the things they did was to look at maternity leave policies and to beef those up, arguing that a strong early bond was probably going to pay off for all of us in society later on, and that it was worth doing so. And that was one of the things they saw that did make a difference.
Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons why that is so important in this early period of time, I'm going to extrapolate my understanding a little bit, and I want you to correct me, is that, as you said, we're having a huge amount of brain growth. I think that baby's head gets 80% of its adult head size by age 2 or so. So there's a tremendous amount of brain development, but at the same time, the brain is pruning away unused neurons that are not stimulated. And at the same time, those stimulated neurons are making more and more and more connections more rapidly. And so no other time in life is that much intercommunication being done to set up these long-term patterns. I may not be saying that very accurately, but the idea is that's one of the, to expand on your suggestions of why this is such an important period of making long-term effects on our child development, our brain development.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable way of looking at it. And, you know, the other part of it is to step back from the, you know, what neurons are wiring where, because, you know, our brains are not exactly an old-fashioned telephone switchboard where you can say, you know, this connects to this, as you well know.
Right.
But I think there's also thinking about what are the results of what happens. You know, what are the outcomes that we want to see? Because the preschool teacher or the kindergarten teacher or the parent or whoever doesn't necessarily care about this neuron wired to this place, but they care about, okay, but how is my child doing, and what is their ability and capacity to learn? Because we hope that children are arriving on the first day of school and, you know, in kindergarten with quite a few abilities and capabilities. I have some patients, you know, I work at a community health center. I work with a largely underserved population. We are hoping that kids are able to show up with good behavioral self-regulation, with good emotional self-regulation, with knowing some basic concepts like how to share, how to take turns, how to wait your turn, things like that. And I have some patients that are really quite smart. You know, if you do IQ testing, if you do all sorts of other things, you can find that, wow, they're really intelligent, but they have so many behavioral and emotional barriers mm-hmm. that are mm-hmm. keeping that intelligence from coming out that potential is really lost. It's mm-hmm. just not able to come out. And when kids are starting on the first day of school without some of these basic fundamental concepts and abilities, then there's a lot of time spent remediating. And again, I'm not at all implying that you give up by the time they're age five, but wow, it would have been much easier if we had managed to make some sort of difference early on.
That's kind of those examples that you were given as some of the reasons I think our federal government has begun to promote early childhood exposures to reading and activities that might promote the brain developing in a much more useful way and getting ready for school and so forth than to have lost that period of time.
Yeah, and you know, there's sometimes I think this notion that, oh, you know, these are 6-month-olds, these are 1-year-olds, these are 2-year-olds. Why in the world are we spending time and money and effort on teaching them these mm-hmm. quote-unquote simple things? But, you know, to that young child and their developing brain, these aren't simple things. These are actually complex things that they need to be able to master. And once they've mastered those things, they can now build on those skills to the next more complicated set of skills and really move on, you know, piece by piece, moving up through that.
We have been at this almost 30 minutes already. It's been very fast from my point of view, and I do this for a living. is there anything before I think this is a natural place to take a break, unless there's something else about this childhood development, brain development that we ought to talk about before we come back and then talk about environmental influences such as reading and toxic stress, perhaps for the second half of the program. Anything we need to make sure we get out on the table right now?
No, I think the only thing I'll say is that this is such a fascinating world that we're learning more and more about, and to realize that the observations that social scientists and others have made for really decades, we're now managing to see the biological basis for these changes using functional MRI and brain scans of various sorts have really kind of brought this all together to say, okay, wow, we're starting to see this cohesion between very different fields of study, and that is just remarkable to see.
We remind our listeners once again, this is Line 1, your health connection. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with University of Wisconsin pediatrician Dr. Dipesh Navzaria. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're discussing the importance of reading, which we have not gotten to yet, and some of the other effects of the environment on brain development with Dr. Dipesh Navzaria of the University of Wisconsin. He's got a master's degree as well as an MD degree, a master's degree in public health and library and information sciences. You can email your questions to us over the next half hour at line1@alaskapublic.org, or our local number is 550-8433. And please remember that we repeat this program between 9 and 10, but it's a taped recording each Monday evening, and you can't ask questions, and we won't be available to answer your questions then. So if you have questions or comments that are coming up, this is the time to do it. And also remember, you can go to www.alaskapublic.org anytime and look at the Line 1 archives to look at past programs. I also want to mention that on our website there are several links, one of which is to a video of Dr. Navzaria talking about early childhood development, which you'll get to see if you wanted to, some of this face-to-face time, serve-and-return information that we he had talked about earlier with infants and mothers, and how children appear to be learning behaviors by that activity. So we've talked about how the brain is developing, and we've implied some of the influences. Let's talk about, in particular, how reading, particularly early reading, relates to our understanding of child development and how it influences brain development.
Great. So there's, the key question really comes down to, when we have all the science and other information about the early brain, fine. But what in the world do we do when we have a patient in front of us in the office? What do we tell them? What do we tell the world about things they can do? And really, one of the key things came out of the Reach Out and Read program, which started in Boston 24 years ago. And it, the brilliance and genius of this model, I wish I had thought of it. I didn't. Is that families should be advised to share books with their young children from the earliest days, just as much as we tell them to put them in car seats and, you know, get their immunizations and feed them right and all those things, that the advice to share books together is as important to their ultimate well-being, including physical health, as anything else that's out there. And that's really what the Reach Out and Read model is, and that's what I spend a lot of time promoting. We advise families. We usually start at about the six-month checkup, and we go all the way until they're in school, 5 years. But there's nothing saying that we can't do it sooner or continue doing it when they're in school and in through their adolescent years. And it's not just about reading. It's really about learning to love books and share books together. We're not pushing children to learn to read early or anything like that. If they do, that's great, but it's certainly not a key point. And there's so much that comes when a child and a parent share a book together. First of all, of course, there's those wonderful bits I was talking about, relationships and supportive relationships. This, having a child in your lap or tucked in next to you as you look at a book together, That's just that physical closeness. It makes a child feel loved and cared for. And it's a chance for them to focus their attention together on something. You know, families of all socioeconomic strata face so many challenges in terms of their time and attention and so on in today's world, that to have that quiet moment to just sit together, even for 5 or 10 minutes, has such great emotional benefits. Looking at pictures together, looking at words together, and, you know, one of the big things for children that are young is that, you know, before age 3 or so, certainly a 2-year-old, they don't realize that those funny black marks on the bottom of pages that we call, you know, letters and words, they don't realize that that means anything. They think that when you, an adult, are reading a picture book out loud to a child, to them, they think you're telling the story just by looking at the pictures. And wow, you're doing it the same way every single time. Isn't that incredible? Whereas when they're 3, if they've been read to regularly, they start to realize that there's something about what you, the adult, are saying and what those little black marks on the bottom of the page are. And they start to realize, wow, print conveys information. And this is such a huge leap. You know, we adults, we forget this because it was so long ago for us, but that leap is absolutely tremendous for their learning, because so much of how we convey information in our society is through text, through print, whether you're doing it on paper or on a TV screen in front of you or, a handheld device or whatever.
And I don't know if you mentioned that. Sometimes I'm distracted looking at my screens here, but it increases language or literacy acquisition at the same time. Are we setting up ways in helping develop language and literacy as well?
Mm-hmm. Certainly it does. There's some great studies looking at the number of rare words per thousand in different types of texts. So mm-hmm. How broad is the vocabulary? How different are the words? How many synonyms for words are we using that we wouldn't otherwise? And the interesting thing is, if you look at spoken language, including probably what I've been saying on the program here today, we don't use a lot of the breadth of the English language that's available to us when we're talking to each other, even casually and even in more formal ways. But if you look at and television's about the same in terms of the breadth of language that's available. But if you look at print sources, it's just 2 to 3 times more rare words per thousand than in the spoken text sources. So my favorite example is always in Murray Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are, which is, yes, one of my favorite picture books. You know, when Max arrives there, the wild things roar their terrible roars and roll their terrible eyes and show their terrible claws and gnash their terrible teeth. Now, I don't use the word gnashed in everyday conversation, but for... You know, the other thing that a child gains when they hear that word is they think, you know, again, if they've developed these strategies, they think, oh, I don't know that word, but, you know, the other things are scary things that the wild things are doing. So gnashing must be something scary with the teeth. And, you know, that's actually a really good working definition, and they can just go along with that instead of having to get hung up on the fact that they didn't know one word. And that those strategies will serve them well in school and the workplace and throughout their lives. You know, how do you extrapolate from context?
Why is it, I'm assuming others have noticed it, that my kids always wanted to read the same books over and over and over again? I must have read Green Eggs and Ham by Dr. Seuss 1,000 times to one of my daughters. What's the reason for that?
You're saying you didn't like reading it in a box? You did not like reading it with a fox? No. So there really is a familiarity that's comforting. And this even extends further up to kids when they're reading on their own, looking at formula fiction, you know, the books that all basically have the same plots, you know, the same characters, but, you know, slightly different storylines. There's a familiarity and a comfort, and especially for a child who hasn't yet learned to read, hasn't learned to decode print, it gives a sense of mastery. If they say, I know what's happening next, I know what's coming next, then... To be able to turn that page and say, yeah, I know that in this next page such and such is going to happen, is really a great comfort for them and really takes them so far, because that's one thing they can't control yet when they are developing that mastery over print and text and language like that. The other thing that they gain is this knowledge of narrative. You know, we mentioned earlier at the beginning of the hour about narrative. To learn that a story has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and has a narrative arc. Even the simplest of picture books and board books have wonderful narrative arcs. One of my son's favorites was Sandra Boynton's Dinosaurs Binket, which is about the board book with little pop-up flaps about a dinosaur who can't find his well-loved blanket. And to a toddler, this is high drama. I mean, oh, yes, he understands. He can't find his favorite treasured object, and the narrator doesn't understand. And then finally, of course, the binket is found. This is climax of tension, and the blanket is found, and everything is all good, and the world is all right again. I mean, this speaks deeply to their experience and the reality that they live in.
This early exposure to language was investigated by lots of people. One of the authors I want to mention is Todd Riesley, who is actually from the University of Alaska in Anchorage, and always practice here. I think Todd was a guest on this program years ago, and I'm pretty sure he's now retired. But that was an interesting bit of research that he published along with co-authors in the book Meaningful Differences in Everyday Experiencing Young American Children. Are you familiar with that bit of work and what it's how it's led to our understanding of children?
Yes, it is an absolutely incredible study that they did. It was largely done, I believe, in the early 1980s. The book itself wasn't finally published till the mid-90s. What they did was, this was unprecedented. They went into everyday American homes, and obviously with permission, and they recorded what was going on, what the interactions were like between young children and adults in the house. And of course, it was odd at first to have someone standing there recording, but all they were doing was recording, and no intervention, no training, nothing else. They just recorded. And after a while, the families essentially got used to them and forgot they were there. And what they were able to do with all these recordings was to then sit and analyze them. And as you can imagine, hours upon hours upon hours, this is a lot of painstaking work. And this is why it's not been replicated on the same scale, again, because of all the work it takes. And they found what happens in terms of the environment children are in these everyday American home environments. And they found a few things. One of the most interesting findings was the number of utterances directed at children. So this is how many times did an adult say something directed at a young child in the home. And they found that in the poorest families, you know, there was a lot of language being directed at those kids. It was almost 200 times an hour that there was an utterance. But then they looked at the richest families, and they found, wow, there's almost 500 utterances an hour being directed at those kids. And really what this comes down to is that by age four, the poorest kids are hearing 20 to 30 million fewer words than their more affluent peers are exposed to. 20 to 30 million words, that's where the achievement gap starts, because they're not hearing that language directed at them. Mm-hmm. And that gap is sometimes because no one's talking to them, and sometimes it has to do with things like television. I hear a lot from parents, oh, we have the TV on, but my young child doesn't even look at it. Well, true, but if everyone else is watching the TV or not saying things because the TV audio is on, that's less language directed at the child. So we're seeing the effects of that play out than when you look down the road at IQ and school achievement and all those sorts of things.
Hmm. So also I think it's reasonable to conclude that the evidence supports that all this early stimulation with books increases the likelihood of school success.
Yes, because there's a few things that go along with it. One, of course, is, you know, learning your letters and your words, and early recognition, of course, certainly helps things. But this idea that a book is held in a certain way and that you open it and it has fun things to do, it's stories and togetherness and all those things, for a book to have those positive associations is great. And, you know, it makes my job easier as a pediatrician. I always walk in with the book in my hand. It's coming from me. I give it directly to the child. I don't give it to the parent. I want to see what the child does with it. And if, you know, the child, if they're 18 months or older, I give them the book upside down on purpose. Not because they can read and recognize the letters are upside down, but because they realize something doesn't look right about the picture on the front. And if they've been read to, they have that ability already, and I look to see, do they try to turn it up? The 3-year-old or the 4-year-old who runs up to me when I walk in with the book in hand says, oh, if you give a mouse a cookie, oh, I love this book, and grabs it from my hand and starts to turn the pages. Well, they ran up to me, so I've learned something about their gross motor skills. They turned the pages nicely. I learned about their fine motor skills. I heard language, vision, because they saw the book and recognized it. I know they're being read to. If the little toddler turns, I see this all the time, they turn and hold the book that I just gave them out to their parent in that universal gesture of read to me. Great. I know they know what this is. And the opposite, unfortunately, is when I see the young child who doesn't seem to know what to do with the book. I once saw a 4-year-old. He actually wasn't even my patient. I was seeing his sibling. I'd never met this family before. And I happened to hand a book to the 4-year-old as well. And out of the corner of my eye, I noticed that he was sitting there for the entire visit with the book upside down, backwards, and closed. He didn't have the intellectual curiosity to open the book. I can tell you without saying a word about him, looking at his chart, knowing anything about him, that I'm deeply concerned about him and his ability to be ready to start kindergarten in a year, because he didn't have those that toolkit of skills, the curiosity, the dexterity with the book, the familiarity that I would want him to have to really be able to succeed in kindergarten.
Let me take just one more time to remind listeners, if you've got questions or comments about our discussion today about childhood brain development, particularly early effects of environment and genetics, or the importance of reading, and we're also going to get into just shortly about toxic effects or effects that may not be as beneficial as reading for sure. You can reach us in the next 10 to 15 minutes at 550-8433. Or you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Also, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Just briefly, do you notice any – well, before I ask the next question, I also want to not forget to remind listeners that you will be up here next week, and in particular, there's a public – lecture that you're giving Monday, September 16th at the Lucex Library from at 7 p.m. on early childhood brain development and literacy. Is that correct?
That is correct.
There are some professional lectures as well, but this is one that's open to the public at the Lucex Library next Monday, September 16th at 7 p.m. Dr. Nesveria will be discussing these topics again. What about cultural differences? Is there any reason to think that certain cultures in the world are better at promoting these activities that encourage literacy that you've just expanded on that make kids better and more readily available for school than other cultures?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's a lot to be said about culture and interaction. Again, if you think about many, quote-unquote, traditional cultures, I mean, so much of what we see universally throughout the world is this notion of caring for one another, of building strong, supportive relationships, as I alluded to earlier. Shirley Bryce Heath did some really excellent work in the U.S. looking at sociocultural differences in reading style. She looked at some North Carolina communities, and I'm not going to be able to do justice to the nuances of her work, but briefly, one of the findings that she had was that if you looked at upper middle class Caucasian communities and how they read with their children, it was much more of a dialogue back and forth. It was a picture books, stories. As the kids got older, they were encouraged to not interrupt, but wait till a pause in the story to ask a question or to raise their hand or whatever. And, you know, these are all, you know, no one was setting out to do this, you know, like, oh, we must teach them these skills. But these are the sorts of skills that you can imagine would serve them well in the classroom setting. Now, if you looked at the working class Caucasian families, there was also an emphasis on reading, but it was much more kind of a drills and skills. Here's a workbook on recognizing your letters. Here's something on counting, you know, and there was less about story and narrative and much more about the mechanics of it. And again, extrapolating, perhaps because their parents had had struggles in school and were thinking, well, if I teach my child these tools, that it'll be much easier for them. And then for the working-class African-American communities, there was also wonderful story and narrative and rich traditions, but much of it was oral, at least at that point when she was doing this work. And there was also an encouragement to interact back and forth, for the child who's a listener of the story to call out a response or something in the middle, you know, to aimed at the storyteller. And of course, that also goes back deeply into tradition. But if you think about putting that same child who's used to that sort of back and forth into a classroom setting, all of a sudden you have that child who, doesn't listen, is impulsive, blurts out answers and things like that. So certainly there's a lot of intersection of culture and meaning that goes on behind all this too.
I want to ask you to talk about the the idea of toxic stress and its effects on brain development. But let me just say we've also suddenly got a couple of phone calls and an email that's got a question. But I think the most important thing is to get in this idea of toxic stress. And then as time will allow, we'll try to address some of the questions that are being asked by others. So tell us what we know about this idea of toxic stress and its effects.
Yeah, so toxic stress is really an interesting idea. What I will start off by saying is by defining toxic stress. Toxic stress is not a single bad stressor or a single major event or anything of that nature. It is the prolonged activation of our body's stress response systems, you know, and releasing hormones like cortisol and epinephrine and all that. And there's very little of that buffering socio-emotional relationships that helps make a difference there. So toxic stress is things like homelessness. It's like food insecurity, child abuse, substance abuse, and violence in the environment, you know, all those sorts of things. So toxic stress is adversity. You know, there was a very interesting study done in the 1980s where they looked at adverse childhood experiences, not adult adverse experiences, but childhood. First time they looked at globally at all these different types of childhood adversity, and then they said, okay, what was the effect over time? Well, if you looked at the child in the first few years of life, if they experienced more of these adverse events, did they have worse developmental outcomes? And certainly they did. When you got to 5, 6, 7 of these adverse events, we found that their risk of developmental delay was virtually a guarantee, you know, delayed language, delayed gross motor skills, you know, those sorts of things. Then they looked and said, what happened later on? And the most astounding finding was that the risk of heart disease as an adult was 3 times the risk if someone had 7 or 8 adverse experiences as a child versus someone who had 0. So something about adversity in early childhood was really making a difference here. It's baking into the biology changes in the stress response system that are playing out in physical health 50 years later. And the thing is, this holds up for not just heart disease, it holds up for a whole slew of conditions. This has been replicated over and over. I know there's a Wisconsin-specific study looking at this, and over we're seeing that early adversity has repercussions that really go across the lifespan.
Yeah, there's been studies in multiple countries. There's a famous group of epidemiologic studies called the Whitehall studies from England that if people are listening and wanted to look into this a little bit more, where equal access to health care had very, very different outcomes depending on socioeconomic strata, and it's suggesting that there's something going on other than health care issues that lead to our outcomes.
Right.
A question from an emailer. How do you deal with parents who are resistant to getting feedback and need a greater parent and child interaction, particularly those individuals that are picked up by infant learning programs who are trying to address these issues?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And, you know, I as a pediatrician, I always start from the basic assumption that parents want the best for their child, and that they're trying to often make do with a lot of limited resources and limited time, and are often having to prioritize. If I'm supposed to bring my child to such and such program, well, that's great, but when am I going to be able to do these other things that I need to hold my household together or things like that? So sometimes I think it's exploring the nature of why they might be less likely to want to contribute. You know, building a relationship with them. There are times when I see issues on the first time I see a child, and I realize that, you know, they've never met me before. There's not really that trust there yet. It's probably a better idea for me to take a few moments, you know, start with small things, have them come back, you know, do another visit, and then over time, as we get to know each other, start to explore and see what else we can do. It is hard, and I think the other thing we have to do is think about what is it that causes that family to have trouble following through. If they're more worried about where their dinner's going to come from that night, or they're worried about being able to make their rent or mortgage payments, well, frankly, that's probably a bigger concern for them than what may sound like a very nebulous concept about their child's development, because it's more immediate.
Okay. Let's try to take one phone call. Charles, you're on line one, and we've only got about 3 minutes left, so if you could be as succinct as you can.
All right, Dad, I'll try to be quick. I do work with a group that tries to support struggling schools around Alaska, and we've got some very, very low school achievement, especially in rural Alaska. And one of the main factors is, as I'm sure you are aware, is students arriving not ready for school, maybe two or more years behind. And the other statistic we have in Alaska is we have the lowest penetration of pre-kindergarten in the United States, of all the states. And I'm just wondering if there's research or you have response about school success and pre-K, and is pre-K a way of dealing with some of these problems you're talking about with families that don't have the verbal interaction with their children that others do?
That's a great question, and I think the preschool years are tremendously important. In fact, there's looking again at the Risley and Hart studies that were mentioned earlier, we can measure disparities in vocabulary as early as 18 months of age between various socioeconomic groups. So we know that that's happening at 18 months. We know that the brain changes are already happening earlier, so it even goes earlier than the traditional preschool setting to down to infancy. I think that the great thing about the preschool environments and earlier is that they can start to intervene again at an earlier point where there's greater capacity for the brain to change, and it can allow children to start having the benefits of some of that structure. And certainly in the families and environments where there's a lot of chaos and not necessarily optimal support, sometimes having a caring adult and a consistent caring adult in the form of an early childhood educator or a home visitor or anything like that can at least provide some of that buffering effect for that child and can hopefully make a difference for them so that when they do start, they're at least not as behind, and of course ideally caught up, but at least not as behind as they might have been otherwise.
Thanks for your call, Charles. How about just summing up briefly with a couple of key concepts we want to make sure people try to remember today?
Certainly. I think one of the big ones is that relationships matter. Adult-child relationships, human relationships matter deeply to the development of children. If we want children to succeed, it's going to be through interacting with adults, learning from adults, hearing language, singing, reading books, all those sorts of things together. And that matters for every single child, because it's terrible to think about a child already being set up, already failing before they even have entered kindergarten. Just like they said with, you know, the auto bailout, too big to fail. Well, children are too small to fail. We don't want them already being consigned to poor outcomes before they've even made it to kindergarten. Reading is one of the great ways to do this sort of work together. Even if a parent can't read well, they can look at pictures together, they can share books, they can use audiobooks, all those sorts of things. And of course, public libraries are just one of the great civic resources we have that really helps enable all that together.
Boy, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us, Dr. Nefzaria. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you'd like to continue this conversation, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link at our website, www.alaskapublic.org. Next week, our guest is Karen Curtis, who became a vigorous national advocate of preventing medical errors after her father passed away following a preventable medical error after a lung transplant. So why not tune into your health next Monday and learn more about preventing medical errors. Pat Yak is Chief Contact Officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and was the audio engineer for today's program. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. I'm Dr. Thad Wood.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.